What does motion sound like? With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, North Korea, a new tax pitch, General Flynn under investigation, no money for the wall, and no new health plan at 100 days. In an interview with Reuters yesterday in the Oval Office, President Trump said armed conflict with North Korea is possible.
There's a chance that we could end up having a major, major conflict with North Korea. Absolutely.
Michael Flynn in trouble again. House Oversight Committee Chairman Republican Jason Chaffetz said generals can't do what Flynn did under the law.
As a former military officer, you simply cannot take money from Russia, Turkey, or anybody else. And it appears as if he did take that money, it was inappropriate.
And a one-page tax revamp comes from the White House Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin.
Under the Trump plan, we will have a massive tax cut for businesses and massive tax reform and simplification.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with NBC's Kelly O'Donnell, The Wall Street Journal's Naftali Ben-David, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. What do you see in Trump's tax sketch on the Korean front on NAFTA at 100 days? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining us now from Washington is Kelly O'Donnell, lead Capitol Hill correspondent for NBC News, covers Capitol Hill, the White House, national politics. Kelly, welcome. Great to have you here.
Great to be with you again.
And from Washington, Naftali Ben-David joins us, Washington editor for The Wall Street Journal. Naftali, thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
From Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Naftali, and Kelly.
All right, let's go straight to North Korea because we have this interesting pair of streams of commentary here. Rex Tillerson on the air this morning, you may have heard it, with Steve Inskeep of NPR, saying, you know, he had already said the era of strategic patience is over. He said in the past the U.S. would wait for North Korea to act up and then push for talks. He said now there's not room, there's not time for that approach. Here he was.
We don't have the running room left to do that now, given how far advanced their program has become. So this is an approach that is to put pressure on them through implementation of all the sanctions, as well as other diplomatic pressures and calling on others to cause them to change their view of what will really allow them to achieve the security that they say they seek.
Kelly O'Donnell, you've got the president talking with Reuters in the White House about the possibility of a major, major confrontation. Absolutely, he's saying. And Rex Tillerson saying, what we really want here is talks, but talks on our terms toward the goal that we want. Is this a good cop, bad cop approach? Or what's going on here, Kelly?
It certainly seems to have that kind of dimension that Rex Tillerson, who is the most responsible for the direct contact with those in the region, the foreign ministers of other nations, trying to be a little bit more pump the brakes, and the president really living up to the kind of bravado we're used to from him, where he is provocative, and at the same time, he is also trying to caution that the answer, as he sees it right now, runs through China. The president has been really notable in how he has praised President Xi of China, calling him a friend, saying that he would not, meaning the president of the United States, would not take actions that are critical of China right now when he needs the help of President Xi. Through the personal relationship they have, through a belief that President Xi is taking some action toward North Korea to use his influence there. And so we've seen the president, President Trump, saying that he's not going to deal with issues like Taiwan, not going to deal with issues like currency manipulation, give China some breathing room here for the benefit of hoping they can blunt the threat from North Korea. Rex Tillerson and the president are largely on the same page. Tactically, they're going about it differently.
Rex Tillerson saying, we're not here to give something away. We're here to demand something or to ask for something. And he says it's the same thing that China wants. Here he was again from his conversation with Steve Inskeep of NPR.
A denuclearized Korean peninsula. It's very clear. That's China's stated policy. It has been our stated policy. It's been the stated policy of our allies in the region. And I would, you know, would quickly add, you know, we did our part. We took our nuclear weapons out of the Korean Peninsula. It's time for North Korea to take their weapons out as well.
Is that a realistic goal?
It is our goal. It is our only goal.
This Secretary of State does not speak often. It was interesting to hear him. Naftali, does the U.S. have some new leverage here that we haven't seen before? Is China really going to swing in alongside the U.S. to push for this to happen? He's not really saying how it's going to happen. It's just that it's the goal. And the president, meanwhile, is talking major confrontation as if we don't get it, watch out.
Well, that's what strikes me, is it's not really clear there's any difference in policy between this administration and the last administration. I mean, what's different here is the sort of fiery rhetoric, the very strong, forceful demands by the president. But really, the policy all along has been, we're going to pressure North Korea as much as we can with sanctions. We're going to work with China to try to get them to exert their leverage. You know, most likely there's not going to be a military confrontation, but we're not taking anything off the table. I think the biggest change we're seeing here is a change in rhetoric, to tell you the truth. I mean, our options are limited when it comes to North Korea. It's perhaps the most vexing foreign policy problem of this president, but also of the previous president. It's interesting to watch the dance that the U.S. is having with China, in part because President Trump has in the past, particularly during the campaign, been fairly critical of China and talked, of course, about trade and various other issues, currency manipulation. And now there's a very complex thing going on, I think, a dynamic where the president's trying to continue to exert some pressure on China, but he knows that he needs China and he's backed off in some key areas. So I think you're seeing a lot of complicated things happening with Rex Tillerson's personality and diplomatic approach, the president's own approach and sort of political style, the relationships with China. But in some sense, it's hard to see a specific different policy goal or approach than what we've seen for years from American presidents.
Jack Beatty, something new here or not?
Certainly in tone, and I don't recollect a president speaking that bluntly about what could happen on the Korean Peninsula, a major conflict. That's not diplomatic talk. I'm just struck, Tom, by the impoverishment of the debate about North Korea. Posit the worst. North Korea has a missile. It can put a warhead on it. It can reach the United States. Horror. Well, the United States threatens a preventive war. We are going to prevent North Korea from striking us by striking them before they get there. That's the threat. Bismarck likened preventive war to a man who commits suicide from fear of death. We did preventive war in Iraq. It wasn't suicide, but it certainly was a disaster. And morally, it is so questionable to say to a nation, we're going to make war on you because you might attack us. You know, we won, or humanity won, the Cold War through deterrence and containment. Deterrence meant that Russians kept their weapons and we had ours, and there was a balance. In that interview with Reuters, the president says, well, he hopes that the North Korean leader is rational. From everything we read, his main objective is to stay in power, which is to say he could be deterred.
Still, easy to be deeply disconcerted by the idea of a North Korean nuclear missile that could reach the U.S. So we heard James Woolsey saying this week, just put one in a satellite in space, blow it up over the U.S. and knock out the U.S. electrical grid. Kelly O'Donnell, bring us back to Capitol Hill and American issues at home. Where do we stand as this week wraps up on funding the government? We had this deadline that was going to run out this week. Everything, you know, could shut down. Where does that stand, Kelly?
I think after the 2013 government shutdown, where there were deep divisions that allowed Congress to cross into that abyss that made everybody in the country miserable, there was zero appetite for that this time around. And so the expectation is that Congress will buy itself additional time by passing a short-term spending package that allows all operations to continue. And that's backed up not just by the urgency of needing to do it, but by the fact that both Democrats and Republicans are telling us they're making substantive progress on funding that would take us through the end of the fiscal year, not just another little blip to get us through another month or another 8 weeks. It would be more substantive, and that there are some of the compromises that voters often say they want and we don't often see. So Democrats have been able to put some pressure on the Trump administration to say yes for border security, but not explicit wall funding. The president will tackle that later. Also, some financial support for the currently existing ACA, the Obamacare law, to keep it sort of supported as it goes forward. Those are big things for Democrats. And at the same time, we see that the House on the Republican side is poised to make changes that could be very big to the health care law, substantive changes. But they don't have the votes yet, and it is the more moderate, centrist Republicans who, as of the last sort of iteration of this, are uncomfortable, concerned about individuals who currently use Obamacare to get their health insurance somehow being displaced by the changes that would be made. So government stays open. Looks like the agenda for the Trump White House is really a big zero on legislative accomplishments, but crisis averted, and I guess we give points for that now, that there's not going to be a shutdown, and at the same time, some continued work happening on changing the health care law. And there are real questions about how much it really would change if they pass this, but I'm also told by sources inside the White House and on Capitol Hill, there's just a real anxiousness to get that promise off the plate to be able to do lots of other things. So we'll see how it plays out.
Is it going to be just the same situation all over again next week, Naftali? They just put it off for 1 week, right? Do we have this conversation all over again?
No, I think there are ongoing conversations about how to fund the government through the end of the fiscal year. And one reason they're able to put it off for a week, I think relatively easily, is because there are broader talks underway regarding the longer-term spending bill, which, again, will get us for another 5 months. I mean, the Democrats won a few notable victories here. There was some talk early on. The White House was demanding, essentially, funding for this wall with Mexico. And the Democrats said no, and the White House backed off and said, okay, we'll deal with that later.
Was it just Democrats or Republicans, too? Some of the border Republicans were saying, forget it, and deficit hawks.
Absolutely. Well, there were certainly Republicans along the border districts and states that were not comfortable with this. It was just not a political winner for them. The idea that the government might shut down because members of Congress were refusing to give in to demand to fund the wall, which, by the way, the president had said over and over again Mexico would pay for. It just wasn't something that was politically sustainable. They did realize that fairly quickly and then sort of backed off that. So the payments for health care, it looks like the Democrats are going to get assurance on that score as well.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news. Korea talk, a tax pitch, NAFTA back and forth, General Flynn's issues, French elections, the Pope in Egypt, and of course, 100 days. Kelly O'Donnell is with us, covers the White House, Capitol Hill, and national politics for NBC News. Lead Capitol Hill correspondent there. Naftali Ben-David is here, Washington editor for the Wall Street Journal. Jack Beatty's here, and you can join us. What's the Trump play on North Korea? War talk? Peace talk? Good cop? Bad cop? What do you see in the Trump tax bullet points? What's in it for you, for the rich, the poor, the middle, the country, the deficit? Should we blow up NAFTA and start again? Is General Michael Flynn headed for jail? Should he be? Secretary of State Rex Tillerson at the U.N. Security Council this morning, that measured tone, but talking tough. He's saying only by dismantling North Korea's nukes can there be peace. Saying for too long the international community has been reactive to North Korea. Those days are over. What does that mean, that it's now to be active in regard to North Korea? I want to ask about the border wall in the midst of all this. As Naftali, you say, this was a big, big issue for Donald Trump on the campaign trail. Mexico would pay for it. It was urgent to get going. But here he was this week telling a reporter at a roundtable with farm workers, well, he hasn't forgotten about it. It's still very important.
The wall is very, very important.
In your first term?
Well, it's certainly going to, sure.
In your first term?
We have plenty of time. Got a lot of time.
We have plenty of time, a lot of time. Kelly O'Donnell, how important is this, and how strong is the opposition to it? Could it be that it won't happen after all that?
Well, there is a question about how much progress there could be. So in this current fiscal year, what they're talking about is money that's available to the Department of Homeland Security could be used in ways that are more broadly popular. Additional technology, drones and so forth, additional personnel at the border, ways to try to address concerns about border crossings. And of course, the immigration and the illegal immigration issue is much broader than that, with visa overstays in the interior part of the country. That, of course, isn't affected by a wall. So there are steps they can take that put the wall on a path, but actual construction of a wall, my best guess is that there could be some section that would be planned, contracts let, and building could begin in a limited way if everything lines up. The president, I think, says that this is something that not only for border security, but he always brings in the drug and crime element of the grave dangers that do exist along the southern border with gangs and with the cartels moving drugs across. So trying to expand the appeal of it. Now, as you've talked about, Republicans in border states don't think that's necessarily the most effective, best use of those kinds of resources. Many lawmakers say infrastructure demands much more attention and the money that goes with it. And there's still a big question about how would Mexico pay for it. Senator Ted Cruz of Texas says perhaps some of the ill-gotten gains of cartels could be directed toward that spending. It's a big, big central part of what Donald Trump said to voters, and trade and immigration were really the things that put him on the map as a possible candidate. So to be in the position now where he is constrained by how Washington really works and how funding really works is a real challenge, but he is insisting that it will happen. So I think what we ought to look for is there a small way for him to show progress that he can point to? The notion of a $20 billion wall being constructed in the first term seems a big reach. So is there something less than that that he can do to claim a victory and to try to say to his supporters that he's taking action?
At 100 days, the president now saying we have plenty of time, a lot of time. Naftali, I want to ask a little more on the health care front. I mean, there was talk that there might be a revamp or a second run at that by Republicans as early as this week. Thursday night, they decided they didn't have the votes to go back at it, at least not right now. They wouldn't go for putting the proposal on the floor today. This was Speaker of the House Paul Ryan talking with reporters yesterday.
We're making very good progress. We're going to go when we have the votes. But that's the decision we'll make when we have it. And something tells you you'll probably be the first to know when that happens.
Are they going to have the votes, Naftali? And if they have them, who's bringing them? Is the Freedom Caucus, the hard right, been brought around? Is the Tuesday group, the sort of more moderate Republicans, mollified somehow? Has the bridge been built?
Well, it's not looking great right now. I mean, you never want to say for sure, but what happened, to sort of put it in the simplest terms, is they moved the bill to the right to get the Freedom Caucus. They did that, but in doing that, they seem to have lost some members of the Tuesday group. But more broadly, really, the only thing that's changed, I think, I mean, they did make some substantive changes to their proposal, but a lot of what changed was just the political moment. I think a lot of Republicans, particularly the hardest line conservatives, were really getting blamed and blasted for, after 7 years of portraying Obamacare as the worst thing ever to happen in the United States, then the minute they actually had the power to do something about it, they seemed unable to do so. So they've shown a lot more flexibility in the last few days, the last couple weeks, really, than they had previously. So these changes were made, allowing states to opt out of some important provisions of Obamacare, and it seemed to satisfy quite a few of the Freedom Caucus folks, but it did not satisfy the Tuesday group folks at all. And, you know, I think more fundamentally, the ACA, whatever you think about it, did seem to shift the way people think about healthcare in this country. And there's a certain expectation that the government make it possible, at least, for people to get health coverage. And that's very, very hard to do while also lowering costs, while also having some of the flexibility that people are talking about. You know, it's turning out to be much more difficult to implement in legislative language than it was to promise on the campaign trail.
Nancy Pelosi, now House Minority Leader, went after Republicans on it yesterday.
I think President Trump is really making fools of the members of Congress of his own party. If they vote on it, the minute they cast that vote, they put doo-doo on their shoe, tattoo on their forehead, and they have to explain it to their children. At some point, they're going to have to explain it to their children. What did they do to make America sick again?
To make America sick again. Jack Beatty, what do you see coming out of all this? Do we end up with some version of Obamacare in the end?
It looks like that, and I think for the reasons that Naftali was saying, that suddenly the country has woken up, and polls even show this. I think for the first time ever, if not from very early days, Obamacare, the ACA, has actually got some marginally majority support. People have come to expect that. And the wholesale Republican attack on that, the 24 million people lose insurance, the massive increase on premiums for older Americans, the fellow earning $25,000 a year who would have to pay $14,000 for his insurance, that sort of fiscal absurdity and horror, it just flies in the face of what seems to be a sort of tacit national consensus. We want at least a floor, at least a level of decency to afford people some health protection. And if you start to look at it, it resembles what people want in pieces Obamacare. They want pre-existing conditions. They want limits. They want on total spending, total premiums. They want, a pretty wide menu of coverage. And they've got it under Obamacare.
Let's look at the tax. I don't know what to call it. The White House is saying tax plan, but it was just one page. So it's a lot of bullet points. But just what fits on one page out this week, Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin talking about it in the grandest terms here on Wednesday.
This is going to be the biggest tax cut and the largest tax reform in the history of our country. And we are committed to seeing this through.
Democrats going straight at it. Here was Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer slamming the proposal yesterday.
I have never seen a tax plan that does more harm to the middle class and more to boost those at the top than the outline released yesterday. I guess it's not quite a plan yet. Let's hope we're not passing legislation on one page.
Naftali Ben-David, you've got one page here. What do you see on it? What does it say about where this administration may be headed? And is it a wish list, a dream, or the bones of a real plan?
I mean, I think the best way to look at it maybe is a set of goals. I mean, and that's maybe the most important thing about it is that it isn't a plan in any sort of fleshed out way. It's not just that it's not legislative language, but it's also that it doesn't provide sort of crucial details about, for example, how these things would be paid for or at what level of income certain tax brackets would kick in. I mean, it's essentially a list of things that they hope to get at some point. Perhaps it was put out this week because of the 100-day marker. It's hard to know. But both the supporters and the critics of it, I think, don't have much ammunition to work with, precisely because it's so bare bones. And, we're so far away from this. Even if it were a plan, it would have to get through the House. It would have to get through the Senate. It would have to win over some Democrats. I mean, we're just very, very far away from this. In a way, this was a restatement of some of the things that President Trump said on the campaign trail, maybe with a little bit more detail. But it's almost hard to know how to look at it, without some more. There's certainly indications that it would benefit some of the well-to-do more, perhaps, than the middle class people. That's something Democrats jumped on right away. One of the more interesting things, by the way, to me is that it seems like it'll hit people in Democratic leaning and liberal states who pay higher state taxes than it would in more conservative and Republican leaning states, which create some very interesting political dynamics. But, to make a long story short, we just need a little bit more information before we know where it's all headed.
You're at the Wall Street Journal. One of the arguments made here is the old Laffer curve argument: cut taxes and you'll get a lot of economic growth. It would take a lot to keep this from really blowing up the deficit, I guess, but we've just got the numbers out today saying in the first quarter of this year, we've got GDP growth of just 0.7 in the first quarter compared to 2.1% at the end of last year. That's the slowest in some years here. Do you see an economic stimulus in this tax sketch? Naftali, is it possible even to say? And what about the deficit it might create?
Well, that's one of the biggest issues. I mean, it seems like it would add significantly to the deficit. The conservative argument tends to be, not all conservatives perhaps, but when they offer a major tax cut that would clearly seem to increase the deficit, they say, well, growth will pay for it. There's some evidence on both sides of that. People have gone back and looked after previous tax cuts and previous tax increases and tried to sort of analyze the effect it's had on the economy. There's some evidence both ways. I think for this one, I think a lot of economists would have trouble accepting the notion that there'd be enough consistent high growth driven solely by this that it would pay for itself. And that's really one of the things we have to see in the future. And it's going to be, in some sense, a challenge to some conservatives and to some people in the Republican Party. You have two of their big principles, lowering taxes and increasing deficits, and some judgments and some calls and some compromises are going to have to be made.
We had the White House saying specifically that they were vague because they didn't want people to be able to score this or to measure exactly what its impact on the deficit would be. This was the White House budget chief, Mick Mulvaney, yesterday on CNBC.
There's no way to score what we put out yesterday. And we did it on purpose, not to try and hide the numbers, but to say, look, this is the first discussion. We learned a lesson during healthcare, which is that we have to be involved in the process much earlier. And that's what you're seeing.
Alfred in Providence, Rhode Island is calling. Alfred, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How you doing?
Okay, what do you see?
Well, it just strikes me that we've just spent the last 8 years crawling out of a deep pit of recession that was created by these exact policies that we're looking at now. Tax cuts for the top, massive tax cuts for the top, massive Wall Street deregulation, $54 billion in new military spending. I mean, the whole thing is it's like an insane bad dream that's coming back to haunt us. I don't understand why this is not being laughed away by the entire country. I mean, and unless you are living in that billionaire category, this is an insult. It's an insult, and it's an attack on 90% of the population.
Alfred, I appreciate your call. Kelly O'Donnell, do you see the GOP solid behind this? I mean, this is kind of an all or nothing. It doesn't look like something that's going to attract a lot of Democratic support. Is this something, unlike the health care bill, that President Trump could get solid Republican backing for, despite Alfred's dismay?
Well, there will be serious differences on key points, but in this sort of bullet point area that we've been talking about, the notion of getting rid of the alternative minimum tax, the death tax, as Republicans call
it. The estate tax gone. That's great if you're rich, like Mr. Trump.
And they always make the argument for family businesses as well. It's a limited number of people who are affected. They tried to balance it by having no tax on the first $24,000 of income and promising lower rates elsewhere, and they want to protect things that people find not only incredibly important in their own personal wealth, but as things you want to encourage in the society. So mortgage deductions would still apply. So that's infusing the home market, the real estate market, a big part of the economy, encouraging people to have home ownership. Charitable giving, same thing. There will be differences. Those who are the most deficit hawk oriented will have concerns, but Republicans want tax cuts and believe that there would be an advantage in especially bringing corporate income and earnings that are offshore back to the United States, and to try to even, especially in the global world we're living in, to even some of the competition for corporations who have to pay at a higher rate inside the United States than they do elsewhere. These things are big divides in the country. People will view it very differently. But some measure of tax cuts, perhaps not full reform, would be likely to pass the House. Of course, in the Senate, you would need some Democratic support. So it would have to include inducements that would be favorable to working families and middle-class families. We are a long way to go, into next year easily, to try to get this into a form where it begins to be a part of our lives. But the conversation has started. It shows the direction the president wants to go. And there are things for people at different income levels to see that they may like. Now, the complications and the implications of how it affects everyone else, that's going to be a long-term fight.
Jack, what do you see in this one-page tax sketch, Jack? And is it just red meat for Donald Trump's base as he comes to his 100-day mark tomorrow?
It's the wrong meat. It's more like filet mignon for his base, that part of his base. I think Nick Kristof puts it well. Effectively, we'd borrow from China or other countries to finance huge tax breaks for Trump and his minions. And this is populism?
Who are his minions? Who are we talking about here?
That is to say, rich people. People who don't like paying the alternative minimum tax, don't like paying the death tax for their heirs, don't like, want to be able to have that pass through so they can pay, they don't have to pay the higher rate on their earnings. They can get the corporate rate, lower rate. All of this would benefit Trump immensely. You know, in the 90s, Steve Forbes ran for president, and he had a flat tax plan. And reporters did the numbers. They applied his income to the tax, and they showed that he would have been a huge beneficiary of his own plan. If that kind of thing, of course, we don't know Mr. Trump's income. We do know some things, though. We know that in 2005, he was obliged to pay $30 million or so for the alternative minimum tax. That would be gone under his current plan.
Support for this podcast and the following message comes from ZipRecruiter, who understands when you run a business, you've got important decisions to make every day, like hiring. ZipRecruiter makes finding quality candidates simple. With one click at ZipRecruiter.com/OP, you can post your job to 100 leading job sites across the web and manage your candidates all in one place with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard. Find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by businesses of all sizes to hire. Try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/OP.
I'm Tom Asbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, Barack Obama joked with an audience at the University of Chicago Monday in his first public appearance since leaving office.
So what's been going on while I've been gone?
Hardy Har, conservative firebrand Ann Coulter, talked with Tucker Carlson at Fox News yesterday about her canceled speech at the University of California, Berkeley.
The police captain's argument was, we can't have Ann Coulter, there's going to be violence. Well, I don't know, call a cop. What's your job?
And President Donald Trump congratulated NASA astronaut Peggy Whitson Monday for her record-breaking stay aboard the International Space Station. It got funny.
Water is such a precious resource up here that we also are cleaning up our urine and making it drinkable. And it's really not as bad as it sounds.
Well, that's good. I'm glad to hear that. Better you than me.
I don't know. That cracked me up. The president cracked me up there. Okay. Honest response. But that's life in space, and she's been up there a long time. Kudos to her. We're looking at a week in the news. Korea talk, a tax pitch, NAFTA back and forth, General Flynn's issues, those French elections, the Pope in Egypt. Brave guy right now. And, of course, 100 days. Naftali Ben-David is with us from the Wall Street Journal. Kelly O'Donnell from NBC News. Jack Beatty is here, and you can join us. How do you see the president at the 100-day mark? Did French voters slow down the populist right-wing tide? Are you sure? Did you want Ann Coulter to speak at Berkeley? Are you praying for the Pope in Egypt? Praying for Egyptians. NAFTA, interesting this week. There were top Trump advisors telling reporters in the middle of the week that the president would announce withdrawal, American withdrawal from NAFTA at a rally this weekend. Then yesterday, the president seemed to change his mind, tweeting, I received calls from the president of Mexico and the prime minister of Canada asking to renegotiate NAFTA rather than terminate. I agreed, subject to the fact, he wrote, that if we do not reach a fair deal for all, we will then terminate NAFTA. He further explained this change to reporters yesterday.
I said, I will hold on the termination. Let's see if we can make it a fair deal, because NAFTA has been a horrible deal for the United States. It's been very good for Canada. It's been very good for Mexico, but it's been horrible for the United States. And if you check my campaign, any of my speeches, I said I'll either renegotiate or I'll terminate. So they asked me to renegotiate. I will, and I think we'll be successful in the renegotiation.
David in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. Hi, David. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom, panel. I could spend the hour, you know, venting about just the misrepresentation and lies, but NAFTA in particular is a Canadian transplanted here to the U.S. I sit, like my fellow citizens in Canada, bewildered by this entire administration, and not the least of which is how it pertains to NAFTA, because as Canadians, we actually take the deficit in trade. The U.S. comes out ahead. And for Trump to tie lumber and dairy and things like that with his bravado, which aren't even part of NAFTA, is absurd. And then his tariff is going to affect his base by every time they go to build a barn, wood's going to cost more. You know, the lumber costs are going to go up. He just lies and misrepresents the truth. And his base, for some reason, I guess out of lack of knowledge, just fall into place. And it's really disturbing.
A Canadian view of what's going on out there, complete bewilderment at this, and something more than that. David, I appreciate your call. Let me get one more. Harper Woods, Michigan. Will, you're on the air.
Hey, hi, Tom.
Hi.
Just wanted to say real quick, if Trump doesn't repeal NAFTA, he won't get reelected. And as far as the Canadian caller said about being uninformed, I mean, go on Google and go to WikiLeaks and look up some of what's actually in NAFTA. And you'll see why Americans don't support it. The problem is that Trump has Goldman Sachs bankers in his administration that are telling him that this is somehow good for the country, and he really doesn't understand it. He's asking rich lawyers who it will benefit if it'll benefit the country, and it won't.
Will, it sounds like you're speaking personally. Are you saying that, among other things, he wouldn't have your vote if he doesn't repeal NAFTA?
He won't have my vote regardless. I'm writing in Bernie again.
All right. We've got some complicated politics in this country. Kelly, what do you see unfolding on the NAFTA front? Was the president dissuaded from just blowing up that bridge up this weekend?
Well, I think if you go back and look at what President Trump said when he was a candidate, he often referred to renegotiate or terminate. So in that way, he is living up to what he said he would do. What is interesting about this is our reporting suggests that there was a leak from the White House, someone who wanted it out there that the president was within days, perhaps, of terminating the relationship with NAFTA. He acknowledged that as much. And now we're seeing President Trump having to deal with his counterparts on the world stage. He knows both of the leaders of Canada and Mexico. There have not been easy relationships there, but we're seeing that he is willing to say, I'll give it more time. So in some ways, what he is doing is what people have said he should do, which is to be a little more measured, to be willing to work with other nations, to try to be more statesmanlike in that way. So he's giving a little time and then still can use the threat of withdrawal from the agreement if he doesn't get what he wants. So this is really an interim test. We won't know how the president performs on NAFTA for some time. Like many of the other things that we have talked about, these are incremental moments. Is there a border wall or not? Is there a withdrawal from NAFTA or not? These are things that the president is sort of moving forward slowly, trying to stay within his lane of what he promised, but also finding that when he is in the White House with the responsibilities of dealing with others around the world, he's trying to show that he can reach out and deal with other leaders when in the past he has been much more black and white about it. We're seeing some shades of gray with Donald Trump.
Jack Beatty.
Tom, could I jump
yes,
in here?
Yes, Natalie, please. You know,
it's not just that he had these sort of well-reported conversations with the leaders of Canada and Mexico. When it was leaked out that he was considering pulling out of NAFTA, there was a lot of very intense lobbying within this country from agricultural interests and other business interests and even people within his own cabinet that were saying, let's be a little bit careful about
farmers
this.
Sell a lot of corn to Mexico, for example.
Yeah, it's a very complex economic thing. And pulling out of NAFTA, it's not just as simple as it would hurt Mexico and Canada, but be good for everyone here. There's a lot of competing and sometimes, you know, conflicting interests, you know, within the country as well. A lot of people whose supply chains may go through Mexico or Canada. So I think two things happened after it was reported that he was considering pulling out of NAFTA. There was the intensive internal lobbying, and then there was also the calls from the foreign leaders that persuaded him to back down. And for sort of, I think this administration often has a bit of a messy-looking process when it comes to determining policy. And so you had kind of a zigzag, whiplash kind of day regarding NAFTA.
Jack, I guess one thing we have to say at 100 days tomorrow is that this is certainly a president who, if it's a negotiating style or whatever it is, he is a maximalist threatener, whether it's North Korea or NAFTA or the wall. I mean, he threatens the big one a lot.
Yes, and in today's times, experts in negotiation say, well, that may work well in private business or in some kinds of business, in real estate, but it's less successful in politics, and they give the reasons why. People can't just walk away from deals and on and on and on. We'll have to see how it works. But, you know, instrumental in changing Mr. Trump's mind on this was his newly installed agriculture secretary, Sonny Perdue, who, as you suggest, Tom, brought him in a map and showed the agricultural vote, the rural vote that went for him and said, Mr. Trump, these people make their money, many of them, exporting corn to Mexico, and this is going to hurt them. And then Will called in from Michigan, but yep. today's Times says Michigan is one of the states that would be most hurt by pulling out of
what
NAFTA.
What is it, because of the manufacturing that goes back and forth across the border
right,
there,
the
auto and more?
The intricate supply chains that have brought all kinds of jobs to Michigan, and you pull that out, and boy, it would really hit that state.
I want to turn to sanctuary cities. There was an executive order. San Francisco, the first city in the country this week, to sue President Trump over that order that would withhold federal funds from sanctuary cities, those not offering up immigrants to federal authorities right away. California federal district judge blocked President Trump's attempt to restrict that money on Wednesday. Here's San Francisco City Attorney Dennis Herrera after that ruling.
This is why we have courts, to halt the overreach of a president and attorney general who either don't understand the Constitution or choose to ignore it.
Donald Trump, it was kind of a see you in court again. Here he was on Wednesday, asked about that Ninth Circuit ruling halting his sanctuary city order.
I'm never surprised by the Ninth Circuit. As I said, we'll see him in the Supreme Court.
Naftali, once again, the president issues an executive order and stymied by the courts. What do you see unfolding here?
Well, it is interesting the way this dynamic seems to be repeating itself. And, you know, when these rulings come down, the president and some of his top officials really go after the judges. And in this case, it was going after the Ninth Circuit in particular. The Ninth Circuit has sort of been a long time, you know, target, I guess, of conservatives. It's the division of the federal courts that's on the West Coast, and it often tends to lean liberal. I think it needs to be said that there are other circuits that lean conservative, like the Fifth Circuit. But the Ninth Circuit is a big one, and it's very influential. And so this devolved fairly quickly into sort of what appeared to be, you know, a battle between the courts and the White House. I think the courts wouldn't see it that way. I think judges would say they're doing their job. But certainly it often seems to look from the perspective of the White House as a war between liberal judges and the White House. I think that's unfortunate. I think it creates a dynamic that's not good. But it seems to be, you know, something that's happened over and over again. And now with the newly installed Justice Gorsuch on the Supreme Court, there's a different dynamic on that court. And I think it's going to be really interesting to see how all those cases end up when they do reach the high court.
Scott in Auburn, Alabama. Scott, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Yes, sir.
Hi.
I'd like to link together the two things, sanctuary cities and Ann Coulter, and tell you that from a cultural perspective, many people think that Trump is a result only of economic issues. And in many ways, he's a result of cultural issues. That the sense that we are a nation of laws, for some of us, but for the rest of us, we are not, that if a bunch of thugs show up to shut down someone's speech, no matter how repugnant it might be, we'll just give in. We'll capitulate. That in federal sanctuary cities, yes, we know there's basic laws, but they just don't apply to some people. I just try to imagine, and again, it's a totally different moral issue, but if the Klan said we're going to shut down some freedom march in the South, I can't imagine somebody saying, well, gosh, people might be hurt, so we'll just call the march off.
Scott, we've got it. You make it very clear, and I'm glad for your call. Jack Beatty, you know, Scott just puts that up as a cultural kind of divide here. You can't just opt out of of the First Amendment or federal law. On the other hand, you got sanctuary cities saying, look, we want to go our own way here. What do you make of Scott's analysis, Jack?
The Ku Klux Klan analogy stopped me in my tracks there. That's a very good one. I mean, in Berkeley, it's some sort of anti-fascist, anarchist alliance of some kind. I think that at the level of principle, he's right. At the level of practice, however, look at how much more complicated it is. On the sanctuary cities, again and again, we hear from the police commissioners in these cities that if they're going to be able to police their cities and keep crime in check as far as they can, they cannot be enforcing. They cannot effectively doing what Scott wants to do.
Sending all immigrants underground, undocumented immigrants underground,
because they won't call the police. And in fact, there have been some data on this that shows domestic violence just going way up. I think in Texas cities for this very reason, the fear, and you know, that's a horrible thing. So that's a practical objection. It's not the level of, you know, principle, obey the law, but it's a pretty cogent practical one. And on the Berkeley matter, again, there's a practical objection. I read the article yesterday from the Berkeley chancellor, and he was pretty much saying, look, we don't want to have these crazy people coming in here and causing a riot. And the Berkeley police chief said, for the campus, said, we can't protect Ms. Coulter against this likely problem.
But you heard Ann Coulter. We played the tape. She's saying, come on, you're the police.
Right.
Your job is to, you know, we have a constitution, so enforce the law.
Right. Well, again, they're saying as a practical matter, yep, we can't rise to that principled level.
Our time is slipping away. Kelly, in brief, is there a chance that General Michael Flynn, former head of the National Security Council, could go to jail because of the money he took after he was in the military and then out from foreign governments?
Well, I don't want to prejudge what the courts would do, but there are some very serious questions about his conduct and his failure to report to officials in the Trump transition, the White House, and through the official channels that he did, in fact, receive payments that can arguably be connected to foreign governments. He did a speech in Russia. He was paid through a speaker's bureau. That puts a buffer there. But the money was coming from an arm of the Russian government.
Pretty skinny buffer.
Exactly. And flag officers, retired generals, are not to receive any money from foreign governments. That's pretty clear. And the fact that he didn't disclose it raises questions about his understanding of that, and was he trying to shield that from being detected? We don't have all the answers, but the White House is saying an investigation is now appropriate. They've sort of distanced themselves from Flynn. They do, in fact, say that the Obama administration was the last issuer of his security clearance. That's a limited but true statement. They also bear a responsibility for vetting him to serve in the president's White House, and they did not find this information. And when you talk to officials, they'll say you can't find what he wouldn't tell you. So there are big questions here. He is far from being clear of legal jeopardy unless there's some kind of an immunity deal. And All the indications we've seen thus far is that that is a reach.
Naftali, very brief, you worked out of Europe. We saw that big election in France. Marine Le Pen is in the final, but we've got the more moderate and more internationalist Macron, who took the most votes there. Is the peak of the right wing nationalist populism been witnessed here, Naftali?
Yeah, I mean, I think what I would say is that we're seeing the limits of it. It's not that it's not an important movement, this sort of surge toward populism and nationalism. But I think after an election recently in the Netherlands, I think there's an upcoming one in Germany that'll probably show something similar. This has its limits. Macron is, you know, described as an outsider. But the fact is, he's a former finance minister of the current government. He's really much more of a centrist and traditionalist. And that's how I'd see it.
Could there still be an upset by Marine Le Pen, the right winger?
I think that's highly unlikely. The other parties are already showing signs of coalescing behind Macron. I think that's by far the most likely outcome.
Well, we're really grateful to all three of you for being with us today as we come right up on the 100-day mark. Naftali, thank you very much for joining us from the Wall Street Journal.
Thanks for having me.
Kelly O'Donnell at NBC News, wonderful to have you as always. Thanks very much for being with us.
So much fun. Thank you.
And Jack Beatty, many thanks to you.
Thank you.
Listeners, thanks for joining us today. And every day, I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.